journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, June 15th, 2011. Sitting in for Sonali Kolhatkar, I'm Hamid Khan.
It just makes me stop and
think. It just makes me stop and
think. It just makes me stop and think.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
A Skid Row resident faces criminal charges related to his activism. Steve Diaz from the LA Community Action Network explains why. Saudi blogger Iman Al-Nafjan discusses the upcoming protest against the ban on female drivers. Plus, the ACLU's Peter Biebring talks about the problems with the LAPD's reporting on observed behavior and the farewell edition of The Right Hook. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Los Angeles Skid Row activist and resident Steve Dogon Richardson is awaiting trial on charges stemming from an arrest at a protest 1 year ago. Last May, Richardson was one of about 300 housing advocates who packed a meeting at the LA City Council to push for rent freeze. The freeze was not approved by the council that night, causing the large group to begin a protest chant. LAPD officers were called in to disperse the crowd, and three participants, including Richardson, were arrested. Witnesses say that the LAPD pushed, kicked, and hit Richardson before he was removed from the room. He was subsequently the only one of the group that was charged with a felony for resisting arrest. Later, the felony was downgraded to a misdemeanor. Richard's supporters, including those at the LA Community Action Network, say the case against Richardson is a veiled attempt at retaliation by LAPD against one of Skid Row's best-known police watchdogs. He's been an outspoken critic of the LAPD and their treatment of Skid Row residents. We have on the phone with us Steve Diaz, a community organizer with the Los Angeles Community Action Network, and John Raefling, the attorney for Steve Dogon Richardson. Welcome, Steve and John.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, Steve, what can you tell us happened last year at the City Council meeting?
Last year at the City Council meeting, it was just another example of a so-called progressive City Council not listening to what the city and residents need. At the end of the council meeting, the two quote progressive City Council members, Bill Rosenthal and Eric Garcetti, were actually the key masterminds behind stopping last year's rent freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And after the motion to stop last year's rent freeze or send it back to committee, basically a political tactic to stop it, spontaneous protest erupted, in which everyone was upset at the failed leadership of the City Council, at which time Dogon was purposely targeted for arrest by SEI officers, who are the same officers committing the human rights violations on Skid Row.
And what is SEI?
The Safer Cities Initiative.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Dogon was targeted by them for arrest since he has been openly speaking against their human rights violations in Skid Row.
I see. And then when you say he was directly targeted, I mean, was it, you know, my understanding is that the group, it was a large group, and they were not asking for a permanent rent freeze, but this was a temporary sort of a moratorium on rent increase for a few months. Is that correct?
Yes. It was just something simple that we thought was going to be right, and we know is right, but the City Council refused to do it. But yes, that's correct.
Given the economic meltdown and the loss of jobs and everything else. There was the advocates and the community residents, they started protesting, and then the City Council, did they respond with very heavy-handedness and full force of the cops?
Oh, absolutely. The council chambers was packed with general service officers and numerous, I can't even put a number to it, officers from the Safer Cities Initiative from downtown.
I see. Now, I understand, Steve, that, you know, because this is an open case, so I would totally understand if you may not want to divulge in too much, but did the LAPD and the cops pull out weapons and tasers and all?
Yes. one of the persons arrested, not Mr. Richardson, was tasered. Numerous beanbag guns, pellet gun, like all kinds of different weapons were seen, as well as people were hit with batons and pushed with their hands as well.
I see. And this was on a crowd that has gone through all the security checks at the City Hall. And then this was a crowd with children and elderly who were there basically asking, going to the People's Hall, asking for a freeze on rent. John, the felony charges were brought against Dogon, Steve Richardson, in May. And then after the initial arrest, but then the DA rejected the charges at the arraignment, and then the charges were reduced to a misdemeanor. Which is resisting arrest, and again rejected by the city attorney. However, the charges could be refiled at any time. So what really happened then after the rejection of these charges? Then these charges were refiled?
Okay, right. To be clear, when the police arrested him, they wrote up the arrest as a felony. And that's sort of their discretion if they believe or if they want to make out the alleged crime to be a felony. So they wrote it out as a felony. The process is that they then submit it, if it's a felony in the city of Los Angeles, they submit it to the district attorney's office. Mm-hmm. The district attorney looked at it and rejected the charges outright. Now, whether they rejected it and kicked it down to the city attorney, which handles misdemeanors, I'm not sure, but one way or another, they rejected it. And so when Mr. Richardson went to the court date on the felony filing, there was no filing. It was what we call a DA reject.
I see.
He was then told to go to the misdemeanor arraignment court a few days later for if there was a filing on a misdemeanor. When we got there, there was no filing, so it appeared to be a city attorney reject. This was in June, so shortly after the incident, which was May 21st. Then he received a letter, I forget exactly when, but sometime around August and September, telling him that misdemeanor charges had been filed, and they were filed in September, or he was ordered to go to court in September. And the interesting thing is that there were a number of other arrests that were made for protests, of different types of protests, including the protests of the Dream Act students and of the various immigration protesters against the Arizona law. And all of them were also brought to court on the same set of 3 days, including the day that Mr. Richardson was there. And this was, I believe, part of City Attorney Trutanich's sort of making a statement that he was going to get tough on protesters in this city. So it was interesting, the timing of the refiling was meant to send a message to people in Los Angeles that the new city attorney was not going to tolerate expressions of dissent.
So in essence, it seems more like this is more of a political trial that we're looking at from the city attorneys, and he's kind of trying to silence dissent, and he's trying to just come down really hard on people who are protesting all these, you know, just hideous policies.
If I can comment on that, it is on a couple of different levels, and I can't read the mind of Mr. Trutanich to say what he's doing specifically with this case, but the filing of the case together with the others would lead one to believe that at least a part of why they're prosecuting Mr. Richardson has to do with this sort of crackdown on dissent that he started last September. The other aspect of how it's a political trial, though, is that Mr. Richardson was targeted by the police officers in the council chamber, and we believe he was targeted because, as you said at the opening of the show, he's an advocate for upholding civil rights in the Skid Row area. He deals with these same police officers day in and day out, and he monitors them. He's out leading groups that videotape and document what they're doing, and he asks them questions. You know, why did you do that? Why did you handcuff that man on a jaywalking infraction? He challenges them, and he goes to police commission meetings, various community meetings around the police, where he brings up what he's been observing out on the streets and challenges the policymakers to change policy. So he's someone that many of the officers down there resent his presence because he's a watchdog in a way.
Absolutely.
And so I think in that sense, there's also a political motivation cracking down on a guy who's been sort of standing up to them.
Right. No, that I was going to actually ask that, too, that why was he being singled out? So, Steve, Mr. Richardson, he's an African-American male who's been living in Skid Row, in the Skid Row community for, you know, just he's lived there numerous times throughout his life and has resided in the community for the past 8 years. How has the community responded to this recent, most latest, attack on him by the LAPD?
Definitely, the community is in full support of Mr. Richardson Dogon. We were there present throughout some of the beginning stages of the court matter. We're going to be there in presence throughout the trial as well, and we're 100% support of Dogon. We clearly see this being as an attack on Skid Row residents, not just Dogon himself.
And is it also that do you feel that maybe this was a message that the LAPD is trying to send to others as well, as to if they raise their voice and if they challenge them, this is the same kind of treatment and that they're going to get as well?
Most definitely, but that's not going to deter no one from challenging human rights abuses at the hands of the Los Angeles Police Department in Skid Row or anywhere else throughout the city of L.A.
So, John, what is the status of the case now? My understanding was that the trial was set to begin on Monday, but it's been postponed for a couple of weeks.
It's postponed till June 27th. So we should be starting it up on June 27th.
Any particular reason why this was postponed?
Yes, it had to do with further investigations needed by the prosecution based on information I gave them from my investigations, but it was an appropriate postponement. We've had a number of postponements as I've conducted my investigations and put my case together, and so they needed the same, and in fairness, they're entitled to it, and I didn't have an argument with them being allowed to continue it. Hopefully they'll look at the material I gave them and look at the case differently, though I don't expect that they will.
I see. So, again, this is an open case, so without divulging into too much information, what can we expect? Given this was the city council, and we just have a couple more minutes left, and given that it happened in front of the council members, what is their role in this case?
The city council members' role?
As far as witnesses and other stuff.
Right. Well, I've attempted to get their documents, their statements related to it, and they've resisted that. They've resisted disclosing any reports or information that they've generated related to this. Assuming that they have, you would think that they all except, I believe, Janice Hahn, were there present watching what was going on. You would think that they would have stepped forward as witnesses and given statements, but as far as we know, or as far as anyone's been willing to divulge, they have not. We did attempt to subpoena one city councilman, and he's resisted that subpoena, and the court has backed him up.
I see.
In terms of resisting that subpoena. So it looks like at this point, unless things change, that no one from the council is going to be testifying, even though they were there. And they saw, if not all of it, they saw certain parts of it.
Okay. So lastly, Steve, why should Angelinos take notice of this case? I mean, some would argue that facing misdemeanor charges is not a big deal.
I think it is a big deal. I think based on this case being used as an example to target human rights defenders throughout the city of L.A., anybody who speaks, this can literally be used as an example to target anyone who speaks up against what's wrong. So if anyone who's out there cares about speaking up against what's wrong and knows that we have a duty as citizens to speak up against what's wrong, that's why they should care about this case. Because this case is just not about targeting Mr. Richardson. This case is about targeting human rights defenders throughout the city of L.A.
Mm-hmm. And where can our listeners get more information on the case and to get, if they want to get involved?
People can definitely call the LA Community Action Network at 213-228-0024.
Okay, and that was LA Community Action Network, 213-228-0024, and we'll put it on the Uprising website. Well, thank you both very, very much for taking the time, and our best to Mr. Richardson, and hopefully, you know, there are other human rights defenders as well who would be supporting him too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I've been speaking with Steve Diaz, a community organizer with the Los Angeles Community Action Network, and attorney John Raefling about the pending case against Skid Row activist Steve Dogon Richardson and the increase in prosecutions of L.A. activists. Later in the hour, we'll talk to ACLU's Peter Biebring about the problems with LAPD's reporting on observed behavior and the farewell edition of The Right Hook. Up next, a recorded interview that Sonali did with Aman Al-Nafjan about an upcoming protest against Saudi ban on women driving. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Steve Skrovan. Join me in an all-star cast of comedians as we stand up for Main Street, a comedy benefit for Public Citizen, Sunday, June 12th at 6:30 at the beautiful Brentwood Theater. Come laugh with Bill Burr, Jeff Garland, Dom Herrera, Andy Kindler, Paula Poundstone, Hal Sparks, and Roy Zimmerman as we stand up for Main Street. For tickets, go to citizen.org and click on the Stand Up for Main Street window. That's citizen.org.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
Welcome back to Uprising. Sitting in for Sonali Kolhatkar, I'm your host, Hamid Khan, at KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, streaming worldwide on www.kpfk.org. On June 7th, a woman named Manal al-Sharif in Saudi Arabia drove her car and posted a video of it on YouTube. Manal was driving with her brother and their respective children. However, Manal was caught in the act and was detained for a total of 6 hours before being released. Later, the Saudi secret police arrested Manal from her home and imprisoned her for over a week. Although not alone, Manal al-Sharif is one of many women who have been driving and posting videos of their actions in effort to increase awareness of women's right to drive. Her action was meant to encourage Saudi women to protest the generally accepted ban on female drivers by getting behind the wheel alone this Friday, June 17th. Another female driver, 45-year-old Najla Hariri, says that it was the ongoing uprisings in the Middle East that have inspired her to take the wheel in pursuit of greater freedom. There is no law against women driving in Saudi Arabia, just society's conventions, stated Najla Hariri. The religious establishment in Saudi Arabia holds fast to a belief that women ought to be chaperoned by a close male relative while driving in cars. Manal al-Sharif is one of the main organizers of the women's driving protest this Friday, a demonstration encouraging women all over Saudi Arabia to drive freely, without the aid of a male driver. She created a Facebook page named Teach Me How to Drive So I Can Protect Myself. The page quickly gained more than 12,000 fans before being deleted. Manal used Twitter to publicize the upcoming protest, but the page information was altered in an attempt to disband and sabotage the growing movement. We now turn to an interview Sonali Kolhatkar recorded earlier this month with Saudi blogger Aman al-Nafjan about the upcoming protest.
Welcome to Uprising, Aman al-Nafjan.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, can you tell us what exactly the story of Manal al-Sharif was? As we've been hearing it here in the news, she was a woman who has challenged the Saudi authorities by driving and posting a video of herself driving on YouTube. Is that as simple as it is, or is there more to the story than that?
Manal al-Sharif, first, before videotaping herself driving a car, what she did was actually start a campaign calling on women to start driving on June 17th, and driving as in just driving, doing their errands, picking up their kids, that sort of thing, not an actual protest or gathering, just to start driving. And to encourage the women, she went out and drove herself. The first time that she did it with a very famous women's rights activist in Saudi Arabia who held the camera, and they had a conversation while she was driving about how difficult it is and how inconvenient it is that we are not allowed to drive. And then the second time, she was actually with her brother and her sister-in-law and their children, because she has a son and her brother also has kids. And that was when she got caught, when she was with her brother. They were stopped. She was taken in for about 6 hours and then released. Then later, in the middle of the night, they came to her house and took her, arrested her then.
Who came to her house and arrested her?
From what I understood, it was the secret police.
And what happened to her then? And what happened to her then?
They took her to the prison, women's prison, and she was she remained there for about, I think, 10 days. I'm not sure, 10 or 12 days.
And so has she been released so far?
Yes, she has.
What was
And she's back on Twitter, and although she apologizes for, you know, the disruption, at the same time, she still stands by her cause that women should be allowed to drive.
What was the reaction to her action and her detention in Saudi Arabia among the press, among the public?
Well, it wasn't just her. You know, there's also another lady, Najd al-Hariri. She drove in Jeddah, and she also posted her video. There's a woman in Riyadh who did the same thing. So you have this kind of uprising. Women are really fed up. You can just imagine living in a country where there's no public transportation and you're just not allowed to drive because of your gender. And you have to find a male to drive you around.
So how have the public responded to this uprising?
It's really hard to say. It depends on who you ask. Because if you're sitting with conservatives, then a lot of them will condemn Manal and anybody who calls for women driving, and they say that it will open doors to sin and women will be able to leave their houses without chaperones and that sort of thing. But for a lot of women, even those who are conservative still are quite, you know, fed up with the inconvenience and the restriction of not being able to drive.
Now, who in the country among the authorities is most against women driving? Does the Saudi royal family have a position on this?
No, yeah, the royal family, King Fahad, King Abdullah. In 2005, he had an interview with Barbara Walters, and he stated that driving is a matter of a social issue. It's not an issue of law, and that he thinks that women should drive, and it's only a matter of time before they're allowed to drive. And basically, all the major royal figures have made a statement similar to that. But it's a religious establishment, actually, that's against driving. And they don't say that it's against Islam to allow women to drive. No, they say that driving itself is okay in Islam. But they think that allowing women to drive will change society in a negative way, that to remove that control over women will liberate them. And then they will be able to go out and do whatever they want without anybody, without any control.
And what is your response to that?
Well, I think that's what being free is about. Being an adult, free person. I think it's a civil right to be allowed to drive your own car. I mean, if you bought your own car, then you should be allowed to drive it. But. And there are a lot of people who feel the same way, even men, because as much as it's a restriction on women, it's also a burden on men to have to drive women around all that time.
I'm speaking with Iman Al-Nafjan. She is a Saudi blogger, and we're talking about the movement among women in Saudi Arabia to demand the right to drive. Now, Iman, what is the situation among women in terms of learning how to drive? If women are banned from driving, how is it that, for example, Manal and the other women know how to drive? Do they take lessons on the sly?
No, Manal has an international license. She got hers in the U.S. A lot of women who study abroad or who spend long vacations abroad get their licenses. Women also get licenses from Bahrain, from the Emirates, and the other neighboring countries. But I'd just like to point out something. Qatar, you know, is a neighboring country, and they had this issue about 15 years ago. They didn't allow women to drive. And what they did, since, you know, they never allowed women to drive until 15 years ago, and what they did was the first year they said only foreign women are allowed to drive. And then the second year they said, okay, now any woman who absolutely needs to drive and who can prove her need, like she's divorced, she doesn't have a man living with her, anything like that, will be allowed to drive. And then the third year, they opened the door so that any adult woman can drive. And I wish they'd just implement the same system here because it ran pretty smoothly over there.
So just kind of a system that or a method to slowly ease it in over a 3-year period. And
yeah, and we have, and it's been done in a society very similar to ours. You know, Qatar, it has the same tribes, basically the same society, and they were able to do it, so it's not impossible.
What would the reaction of the religious establishment be, you know, and how much hold do they have over the secret police, et cetera, to prevent women if...
They don't have any hold on the secret police. It's just that I think what they want, what was meant by imprisoning Manal was to, there was a fear of chaos. Because when the campaign went up to start driving on June 17th, at the same time, a lot of campaigns went up asking for people to go out and whip women who drive and, you know, and harass them and punish them for driving. And when she drove, a lot of sheikhs came out and started to call her sinful and really a lot of... they seriously condemned her publicly. So I think that the point of, you know, taking her to prison was to calm the situation a bit.
Now, Iman, how much of what's happening today in Saudi Arabia is inspired by other rebellions and uprisings in the Arab world?
I can't speak for the women who started the campaign. But I do think that there is this air of possibilities, you know, right now. Before, it was impossible to even think of an uprising, to even think that Mubarak would, you know, be taken down like he was taken down. Impossible to think that what happened in Tunis would happen. And it did. So it really opened our eyes to the, you know, that anything can happen and we can do anything. So it is an inspiration.
What do you make of, just to change topic briefly, what do you make of the situation in Bahrain, where, in fact, Saudi authorities have been playing a role in clamping down on protests there?
I think Bahrain is a special case, special in the way that it is so small, that everything is magnified. If you look at the people supporting the royal family in Bahrain, you'd think that they were a lot. But they're the same people benefiting from the royal family. And if you look at the Shias, I don't know what the situation is really with the Shias, because when I look at their parliament, I notice that the Shias have control, you know, and they have a bit of democracy and they have a bit of a voice. But at the same time, if you drive around Bahrain, the poor areas are always the Shia areas. So there's something wrong there, but it's not in a way that you could say that it's the same case as you would say in a regular-sized country where you have millions of people. It's a very tiny island, and everything is very magnified, and one person would stand for like 1,000 in another country.
I'm speaking with Saudi blogger Iman Al-Nafjan. Now, beyond the issue of women being able to drive, let's talk a little bit about the larger context inside Saudi Arabia. You are a very outspoken online. You have your own blog, Saudi Woman Blog, and we'll post that on our website later today. What sort of freedoms do you enjoy? Do you ever face any pressure in response to your outspokenness online?
Not really. I've never been contacted by the authorities or blocked. I've had friends who aren't as outspoken as I am, and they've been blocked. We don't really understand the logic behind it. But at the same time, I've had a little bit of harassment from regular citizens who think that I'm airing our dirty laundry. They say that I'm always writing about the negative side. I understand their point of view, but at the same time, it's only the bad things that inspire me to write that frustrate me enough to need that outlet. I think I'm pretty free in what I write. I write what's on my mind most of the time.
What role has social media, internet media, new media played in Saudi Arabia? You know, it might not be as easy, might not have been very easy for you to get your voice out before the age of the internet and the age of blogs. And many Saudi women and other activists have been using Facebook and Twitter. And even if those are sometimes restricted and Facebook pages taken down, there's always a way to get new pages up. Do you see the new media as playing a very important role in the movements today in Saudi Arabia?
It's not just important. It's miraculous. It's done something to this country that it fast-tracked everything. We are a very divided country based on tribes, based on regions, based on everything. Socializing is really restricted to people from the same region, from the same tribe, everything else, from the same gender. Even we're segregated by sex as well. So meeting people, talking about things, you're not allowed to start any organizations that are not approved by the government, and the government rarely approves any organizations. So you don't really have any major meeting areas. You don't have, there's no way that you can get your voice out unless somebody makes it easy for you through the newspapers, and that's very difficult. So social media has connected people, and it came in the late 90s, but it wasn't widespread until about like 6 or 7 years ago. People have really started to get online, and the effect is amazing. We're starting to talk, before. Everybody was set in their ways, and you just couldn't get to them. But now you can see the discussion going, people changing their minds, people seeing other people's humanity. Because even before, the very conservative people, they couldn't even recognize other Muslims as Muslims. They were the only ones that were real Muslims who will go to heaven, and everybody's not quite as human as they are. And social media has started to eradicate that.
Well, finally, Iman Al-Nafjan, tell us a little bit more about what's supposed to happen on June 17th now. There are people who organized this or encouraged women to get out and drive on June 17th have put out a certain number of guidelines for women, if you will. What do you expect is going to happen?
The guidelines are you have to have a license to participate, and you have to drive safely, and there will be no protests, there will be no gatherings. You only go out if you have a real errand to run, like you need to get stuff from you need your groceries, you're going to go see your mother or whatever. But
and then are you encouraging?
One survey online, there are 638 women who say that they will come out and drive on June 17th.
And are women being encouraged to also tape themselves and post it to YouTube as evidence of what they've done?
They're already doing that. Mm-hmm. Once a week, at least, there's a new video. But that's a possibility. Yeah, you could do that. That was one. It wasn't a condition, but yeah, you could do it voluntarily.
And will you be running errands on June 17th?
Well, I've offered to accompany anyone, but I don't know how to drive myself, so. But I'd love to get in the car with someone if they want any support in that way, but I'll see. Otherwise, I think that there are 638 women who said that they will go out. I'm not sure about that number, but there are a couple of people who came out with their full names and everything and said, yes, we will be going out on June 17th. And I think that's a good sign, and I think it'll probably play out well. I'm very optimistic.
Well, Iman Al-Nafjan, I want to wish you the best of luck and thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a recorded interview Sonali Kolhatkar did with the Saudi blogger Iman Al-Nafjan about Friday's protest against the ban on women driving in Saudi Arabia. You can read Iman Al-Nafjan's blog at saudiwomen.wordpress.com. We'll link it to it from our website at www.uprisingradio.org later today. After this farewell edition of The Right Hook, we'll be talking to Peter Biebring about the ACLU. Stay tuned.
Welcome to The Right Hook, a weekly segment which covers the machinations of the right wing, from the Republican Party to the Tea Party Patriots and beyond. I'm Chris Bennett. Monday night featured a 7-member Republican presidential debate in Manchester, New Hampshire. The frontrunner for the moment is Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts who passed the health insurance reform bill of 2006. Now, Romney can't even mention his signature accomplishment in life because it is so unpopular with the Republican base. But that's all right. Nobody else on the stage with Romney would mention it either. CNN's John King was the moderator and dangled rhetorical red meat in front of rival Tim Pawlenty. Just the day before, Pawlenty called health insurance reform, quote, Obamacare. Pawlenty, a.k.a. T-Paul, wouldn't lay a paw on Romney, who stood just a few feet away. But he did go on the attack against the most mentioned person of the evening, President Obama. Meanwhile, Michelle Bachmann used the debate to make her formal announcement that she is seeking the Republican presidential nomination. Bachmann is not afraid to blow on Mike Huckabee's old dog whistle. In a pre-taped video announcement, Bachmann twice referred to, quote, taking back the country from Obama, who she once accused of running a, quote, gangster government. While the Republican candidate seemed to be packing the clown car for the long ride down the road to November 2012, the real action is elsewhere. Remember Sharon Angle? Well, she remembers you if you gave her any money during her bid last fall to unseat Harry Reid from the U.S. Senate. Journalist Paul Blumenthal has reported that Angle is blurring the line between legitimate political activity and corruption. At issue is Angle's taking advantage of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision to start her own super political action committee, the so-called Our Voice PAC. Super PACs are able to make, quote, independent expenditures and can accept unlimited funds. It is not legal for political candidates to set up a super PAC. Sharon Angle, at this moment, is not officially a candidate for any office, but her old campaign committee still exists, and there remain some dubious staffing decisions. The treasurer of Angle's Our Voice super PAC is her old press secretary, William Rossovage. He's also the treasurer of Angle's campaign committee. With the Federal Election Commission currently embroiled in partisan gridlock, Angle may be able to continue this game a while longer. But for a woman who just last week threw around the corruption word regarding Washington, no argument there, Sharon, and who inferred in her new book that Harry Reid stole the election from her, Angle may want to check in with Jesus to see what he would do with his super PAC. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, the recall elections against Republicans are underway. Last winter, Republican Governor Scott Walker rolled back collective bargaining rights for union members despite unprecedented protests inside the state capitol building. According to John Nichols of Common Dreams, Republicans are doing everything they can to forestall the inevitable, even running fake Democratic candidates to confuse Wisconsinites. The fake candidates can sling mud and leave the incumbent Republican out of the fight, for a time, sure, but this is a cynical manipulation of the open primary law. One Republican, John Buckstaff, is even running against Democrat Jessica King as a, quote, protest candidate to allow the incumbent Republican more time. This once so-called party of ideas is down to a last bloody grasp on the edge of the electoral cliff. For Uprising, I'm Chris Bennett, and this is The Right Hook, reality-based news and views. This is the last episode of The Right Hook for the foreseeable future. I hope you have enjoyed this weekly take on the right wing, from the loony to the downright dangerous. Warm thanks to Sonali Kolhatkar and the Uprising crew for the opportunity to bring this weekly contribution to you.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to Uprising, sitting in for Sonali Kolhatkar. I'm your host, Hamid Khan. We're live on www.kpfk.org, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 90.7 FM Los Angeles. With the passage of the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, Congress mandated a fundamental reordering of America's intelligence-gathering institutions. It called for the creation of an information-sharing environment, commonly known as ICE, to facilitate the exchange of terrorism information amongst all appropriate federal, state, and local agencies and the private sector through the use of common guidelines and technologies. It further mandated the development of Suspicious Activity Reporting System, or SARS. In March 2008, the then LAPD's chief, William Bratton, issued LAPD Special Order 11, which spearheaded the National Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative. The LAPD Special Order 11 trains and authorizes LAPD officers to gather street-level intelligence and information based upon observed behavior. These behaviors include such everyday common activities as taking pictures or video footage of buildings, as for LAPD's guidelines, with no apparent aesthetic value, drawing diagrams, or taking notes. So whatever happened to reasonable suspicions? Well, now we have reasonable indication. And to talk more about this dangerous and insidious tool for the police, we have in studio with us Peter Biebring, who is a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California in Los Angeles, where Peter specializes in police practices, homelessness, and privacy. His work on policing includes litigation and policy work on civilian oversight, gang injunctions, tasers, racial profiling, and surveillance and national security. He's a lead counsel on Fazaga versus FBI, a class action challenge to the FBI's use of surveillance of mosques in Orange County. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Hamid.
So, Peter, let's get into it right away. Could you lay out for us that what does LAPD Special Order 11 entail?
Sure. Special Order 11 was designed as a tool to get the line officers of LAPD reporting information that might be possibly of counterterrorism value. So what it does is it provides a mechanism, first of all, for those officers to report that information, just a new kind of – there's a new box on their incident reform – incident report that they can check so that an incident can be sent to their major crimes division, their counterterrorism division. It also, and more importantly for our purposes, lays out 48 different behaviors that should be reported. Now, the vast majority of those behaviors are behaviors that police should be investigating, things like stockpiling of explosives or dangerous chemicals, false identifications, things that are crimes. But in the special order, LAPD specifically authorizes officers to gather information on non-criminal activities as well as criminal activities. And these include about six behaviors, some of which you pointed out earlier, that are not just not criminal, but in some cases protected First Amendment activity. Things like taking pictures or videos, drawing diagrams, taking notes, espousing extremist views or bragging about affiliation with extremist organizations, which of course is disturbing depending on who's doing the characterizing of an extremist organization. And the concern is, basically twofold. First, by authorizing officers to engage in investigation of non-criminal activities, the department is really telling its officers to go and initiate contact. You know, potentially, our concern is start detentions, get into situations that might escalate based on things that are perfectly lawful. And then there's a second concern, which is how is that information going to be disseminated and shared to other agencies? Mm-hmm. As you pointed out earlier, there has been instituted a national program of information sharing, And what we've seen is that the suspicious activity reporting is becoming the backbone of that information sharing network. Mm-hmm. Although this really started with LAPD in 2008, the federal government has jumped on the idea of suspicious activity reporting and the creation of a structure and framework for local law enforcement collecting information of potential counterterrorism value. And what they've done is and they've regularized it. So the Director of National Intelligence, which is sort of the federal agency responsible for coordinating intelligence, has, based on LAPD's program, issued a series of documents attempting to replicate the LAPD program in departments across the United States.
I see. So while this raises a lot of red flags, I mean, first of all, the 48 behaviors that you pointed out in this LAPD Special Order 11, those were just they were just randomly created, or do you know what the background of where these behaviors came from?
The department has said that the behaviors were the result of an analysis of a number of terrorist incidents, looking at what kinds of conduct were precursors to terrorist behavior. And I think the concern is that there may be things that are in some ways, broad sense, precursors to terrorist behavior, but that aren't very good indicators of who is going to be engaged in terrorism. I mean, terrorists, before they engage in terrorist acts, eat breakfast in the morning. They put on their shoes, but you can't go around investigating everybody who wears shoes or eats breakfast.
So I could be an architectural major going out there taking photograph of a building, and next thing you know, there could be a national security investigation launched.
I mean, that's the concern. And I think more than the idea that you would be the subject of a full-on FBI investigation, there's a concern. There's an officer who, under this order, has the blessing of the department to go and start asking questions of somebody simply who is taking pictures. So the first concern is what happens in that encounter, and who, in fact, is going to get stopped. If you think about the number of people who take pictures in public in Los Angeles every day, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. Our concern is that police are not likely to stop
a white Caucasian male.
But if there is a person of color, a person who's in Muslim dress taking a picture, police are much more likely to stop that individual. It's basically a concern that when the standards for initiation of a contact are so vague and so broad that the officers have to use their own gut-level discretion about who to stop and who not to stop, and that's an invitation to rely on personal bias.
So we've got basically racial profiling written all over it. The other question I had was, Peter, that you mentioned that there are quite a few of those behaviors which are deemed criminal to begin with. So, kind of raises a question that why would LAPD need a special order for somebody who's, if they observe somebody, just having a ton of explosives or, just firearms and all that. I mean, why a special order to do that? I mean, is it just a smokescreen to add, at least that's what it comes from, that's what it comes across from a lay point of view, that to really criminalize non-criminal activity by front-loading it with the other activity which was already criminal to begin with?
Right. Well, there is one aspect of the order that I think is legitimate, which is making sure that information about criminal activity that might possibly be of counter-terrorist value gets to the counterterrorism force and not just to ordinary criminal investigation. It's making sure that, when an officer is making an arrest for one of the 42 or so criminal issues, that there's an easy way for that officer to say, hey, this may be related to something bigger than this particular crime I'm making an arrest for. I'm going to send this over to the counterterrorism team. The concern is that from some preliminary numbers that the department has provided, those do not seem to be the majority of the suspicious activity reports that are generated. The department has provided data on what reports were made during the first about a little over a year, 2 years of this program. Overwhelmingly, excluding every time the bomb squad is called out, that generates a suspicious activity report for every package. So excluding those, overwhelmingly the largest category of reports is in fact engaging in supposedly pre-operational surveillance or taking pictures, taking video.
Activity that people engage in pretty much on
absolutely.
A regular basis. So also looking at some of the language and just in the interest of full disclosure, I mean, I'm also going to be on a personal level, but I'm on a fellowship and going to be working on the LAPD Special Order 11 piece. So have a lot of interest in this thing. That the whole language has now shifted into from reasonable suspicion to reasonable indication. Is that even a legal language within the codification of or legal code?
It's not. And let me set some context for that. When the federal government, when the Director of National Intelligence was rolling out its document for expanding this program, what's referred to as the functional standards for suspicious activity reporting that other departments should use, the standard that it set for putting a suspicious activity report into the shared database was reasonable indication of criminal activity, which, as you point out, is notably different from the standard traditionally used in the law for stopping an individual or searching an individual, which would be a probable cause if you're going to make an arrest or conduct a search, or reasonable suspicion if you're going to conduct a detention or a pat down. And a reasonable suspicion is defined very broadly. It's any reason to suspect that an individual may be engaged in criminal activity. Reasonable suspicion of that a person is armed can support a pat down. And if you think of the number of pat downs that LAPD or any other agency engages in, it's you can tell it's a very low standard. But the DNI's document says in order to put a suspicious activity report into the information sharing system, it merely has to give reasonable indication of criminal activity, which for at least some period the DNI has argued is a lower standard than reasonable suspicion. And quite frankly, as an attorney, I don't know what that can mean except that it's unreasonable suspicion, that it's suspicion not grounded in any articulable basis.
It almost throws the idea of innocent until proven guilty over its head. I mean, in certain cases where, you know, we're all suspects basically walking around.
There is a fashion. Can I say a few words about how the information is shared and what?
Sure. I mean, we just have about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay. The second part of our concern is the dissemination. Mm-hmm. The idea that the LAPD or other agencies may in fact be gathering and maintaining information on ordinary people based on non-criminal activity. And the policies that have been enacted have done nothing to dissuade that. What happens to a suspicious activity report after an officer writes it is that it goes to the local fusion center where analysts can decide whether it's important enough to put into the information sharing environment, which you referred to earlier, which is this database that's shared with law enforcement agencies nationwide. If a suspicious activity report of Hamid Khan taking a picture in downtown LA is put into that database, then any other place where an agency has reason to investigate you, they may be able to access that report,
say,
he's been stopped in downtown LA. And the concern is that if that is being populated by reports that are not indicative of criminal activity, that there may be this reaction from law enforcement. Hamid Khan was seen taking photographs in downtown L.A., seen at a protest in San Francisco. There's something going on.
I see.
With this guy. Maybe we should look further.
So I'm just like on everybody's radar now, you know, just as a result of that. So, Peter, why should we be worried about it?
We've been here before as a country. Both local law enforcement and FBI collected this kind of information in the 60s and 70s. There was a broad reaction against it when it came out that there was surveillance on political leaders, religious leaders, Martin Luther King. And guidelines were put in place to prevent this kind of spying on innocent Americans. And Special Order 11, the FBI Domestic Intelligence Operation guides are a dismantling of that, and we should be very concerned.
So are we heading towards more erosion of our civil liberties and you know, just our basic rights?
Unless we do something to curb these policies, that's the concern.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thank you so much. I think we should all be extremely concerned, and we're going to be following this, and hopefully I'll get a chance to work with you much closely on this issue and just really raise this issue with our listening audience and the communities out there so we can come together and have this special order rescinded. Well, I was speaking to Peter Biebring, a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California and Los Angeles, about the problems with the LAPD's observed behavior reporting, and that does it for our show today. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Lex Henderson is our intern, and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Listen to the show online and find links, local events, and other information we mentioned on the air at uprisingradio.org. Sitting in for Sonali Kolhatkar, I'm your host, Hamid Khan. Thank you so much for listening.